I'm Edie Betcher, and today we'll be looking at some of the poetry of T.S. Eliot. But before we start Eliot, I'd like you to take the sheets you have, William Blake, The Tiger and the Lamb, and let's just read through these two poems. They present two ways of looking at Christ. We're familiar with Christ as the Lamb of God. We're all familiar with that image, but the tiger is a strange image to us. In this poem, Blake pictures the tiger as being something that required special creative forces. The images are that of a blacksmith shop where the tiger is hammered and forged and produced from heat and great strength. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what the shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? And when the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? The Lamb. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bade thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead? Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly, bright? Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice? Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee, little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. You might just file both of those images back in the corner of your mind until we get in a little bit deeper into Eliot. T.S. Thomas Stearns Eliot is included in both collections of American literature and British literature. He was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1888. His mother, Charlotte Stearns, was a poet of some reputation. He was allowed the widest education available. There was no pressure from his family for him to be practical or to go into the family business. His grandfather was a unionist and an abolitionist and happened to be one of the founders of Washington University in St. Louis. Thomas went to Smith Academy in St. Louis and then on to Milton College in Massachusetts and then to Harvard in 1906. He got the Bachelor of Arts degree in 1909 after 3 years instead of the usual four. And from 1909 to 1910, he was an assistant in philosophy at Harvard University. The year 1910-1911, he spent in France attending lectures in philosophy at the Sorbonne and reading poet with Alain Fournier. Dante, John Webster, and John Donne all helped Eliot to find his own poetic style. 1911 through 1914, he was back at Harvard again, reading Indian philosophy and studying Sanskrit. And in 1914, he met and became acquainted with Ezra Pound. He finished his doctoral dissertation in Europe in 1916, but World War I intervened, and he never bothered returning to Harvard to take the oral exams for his PhD. He achieved some degree of fame in four separate careers as an editor, as a dramatist, as a literary critic, and as a philosophical poet. His first important publication, and what has been called the first masterpiece of modernism, was The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
What did you say that was?
The Love Song of J. Alfred. The first masterpiece of modernism.
Oh.
Nothing like it had ever appeared before. And it's startling, even now, almost 70 years after he wrote it. He starts out, "Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread against the sky like a patient etherized upon the table." Wow, you know, evening is supposed to be romantic. You're supposed to use beautiful images, not the image of a patient lying stretched out on the operating table waiting for the surgeon to start. And the whole of The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock uses images that are strange in peculiar ways. Prufrock, 1917, dates the maturity of 20th century poetic revolution. And some critics have said that Eliot and Pound did for the 20th century what Coleridge and Wordsworth had done for the Romantic Revolution at the end of the 1700s. A collection of Eliot's poems in 1919 contained Gerontian, which is a meditative interior monologue in blank verse. There is nothing else like it in English. And if you've read it, you probably agree that there is nothing else like it in the English language. 1922, the long poem The Wasteland gave Eliot an international reputation. He moved to England in 1916 and became a British subject in 1927 and also converted to the Anglican Church. And one can see a break in the themes and concerns of his poems, those that were written before his conversion and those that were written after.
Converted from agnosticism?
From Unitarianism. His his famous work of literary criticism is called The Sacred Wood. That was published in 1920. A collection of essays was published in 1932. 1930 saw the publication of the complete Ash Wednesday, which was the first long poem he had written after his conversion. It's a religious meditation. It was not well received at the time because poetry was considered to be secular and should not be meddling in religious things. His masterpiece, The Four Quartets, was written between 1935 and 1941, finally issued as a book in 1943, and gained for him the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1948. He is most famous for two of his plays, Murder in the Cathedral, written in 1935, which is about the assassination of Thomas à Becket, and The Cocktail Party, which was first performed in 1949 and then published in 1950. Eliot kept his private life rigorously in the background. It is known that he married in 1915, his first wife died in 1947, and he married again in 1957. And Eliot himself died January 4th, 1965, in London. Even Eliot's religious poems do not contain anything of the joy and delight that we saw in the works of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And his pre-conversion works are, quite frankly, rather bleak. Some of the reading I was doing in preparation for 1984, several of the critics made the comment about what a shock World War I had been to everyone, including the literary figures. This war was supposed to be a just war. It was supposed to end all wars. And yet, there were tremendous atrocities committed on both sides, and a great deal of confusion and cynicism resulted. And Eliot's work, coming in the period post-World War I, reflects a lot of the gloom and the cynical view of modern life, the state of modern humanity. Excuse me. Let's look first at The Hollow Men, which is on one of the single sheets that you have. Eliot was greatly influenced by Dante, and I think very few people in our age, even educated people, have studied enough Dante to really catch on to all of Eliot's allusions. I know I certainly haven't. So I have depended on critics and some of Eliot's own notes in figuring out what he was referring to. The title for The Hollow Men comes from Dante's Inferno, where he writes about the wretched souls of those who lived without infamy and without praise. They were not positive enough spiritually to be either good or evil, just hollow shells. There are two epigraphs to The Hollow Men. Mr. Kurtz, he dead, and A Penny for the Old Guy. The first, Mr. Kurtz, he dead, comes from Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness, which is a glimpse into the heart of things, the evil nature of man. Kurtz had spent time in Africa. His last words before he died were, the horror, as he perceived what kind of a life he had led. Mr. Kurtz, he dead. A Penny for the Old Guy refers to Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot in 1606. He and others plotted to blow up the buildings of Parliament in London. And now in England, Guy Fawkes, November 9th is their fireworks night. Children make effigies of Guy Fawkes and go around. They don't trick or treat on Halloween. They go around on Guy Fawkes night asking for money to buy fireworks so they can have a bonfire and burn the effigy of Guy Fawkes. The implication, I think, is that both Kurtz and Guy Fawkes were men of action. They at least did something. Perhaps they were evil, but they were not hollow men. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass, or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Effigies are impotent, ineffectual, unable to do anything. Old rags stuffed with straw can't really do very much. And that's how Eliot sees us in the 20th century. Our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless, as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Images of dryness and aridity, there's none of the life-giving water or moisture in those images. There has been the suggestion that as children make a game out of Guy Fawkes and his treasonous plot, so we make a game out of our religion. We whisper with our dried voices together, but it doesn't mean any more than that. Eliot's very cynical about religion at this point. Yeah, I think probably all of us at some time or other have had questions. You go to church and you say the liturgy, but it doesn't really mean anything at that moment. Rat's feet over broken glass in a dry cellar. Not a beautiful image. In the second section, notice that the pronoun shifts from we to I. In Dante, eyes are a symbol of spiritual reality. Man lives in the sight of God. And here Eliot starts out. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom, these do not appear. There, the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There is a tree swinging, and voices are in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rat's coat, crow skin, crossed staves in a field, behaving as the wind behaves, no nearer. not that final meeting in the Twilight Kingdom. Death's Dream Kingdom is the kingdom of one unable to commit himself to God. That is the present, unreal, meaningless kingdom of the hollow men, the realm that we live in, between the torture of hell and the bliss in heaven, and with not too much belief in either one. He says the eyes, the spiritual reality, the eyes that he doesn't dare meet even in dreams, these do not appear in Death's Dream Kingdom. Excuse me, in the kingdom that we live in. There, meaning in Death's Dream Kingdom, eyes are sunlight on a broken column. We try to make life meaningful without faith, but art and the beauties of nature are impermanent. They don't really provide any guidance for us. So the voices are more distant and more solemn than a fading star. I think there's a suggestion of the star that led the wise men to Jesus, but in this age he doesn't find a star to lead us anywhere. Let me be no nearer in Death's Dream Kingdom. He doesn't really want to come closer to God's eyes. He wants to wear disguises to escape the eyes of God. And the disguises he lists, the rat's coat, the crow skin, the crossed staves in a field, that is, a scarecrow, these are not proud or pleasant disguises. They're rather shameful, ugly disguises. He doesn't want to come any nearer to that final meeting in the Twilight Kingdom. He's afraid of meeting the eyes of spiritual reality. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in Death's other kingdom, waking alone at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness? Lips that would kiss form prayers to broken stone. Again, the image of dryness and aridity. Life-giving water is completely absent. Stone images are raised, suggests the false gods of cultural values, the things that we worship, the great god Ford, the great god Kellogg, the images that we have placed in front of us every day of our lives, really provide no answer to the spiritual dryness of our century. He says, they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. That suggests the question, is the star perhaps fading because no one is any longer following it? Is it like this in Death's other kingdom, the afterlife? He doesn't know what it might be like in the afterlife, if there even is an afterlife. And this uncertainty prevents commitment. Lips that would kiss form prayers to broken stone. He feels a sense of longing. He would be willing to kiss something if he could only know that there was something there to be kissed. He's not able to believe in God. Part 4. The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdoms. In this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the Tumid River, sightless, unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of Death's Twilight Kingdom, the hope only of empty men. The eyes are not here. The possibility even of faith has gone. There's no spiritual reality in this valley that we live in. This broken jaw of our lost kingdoms suggests the Old Testament exiles, the people who went out with no homeland. We grope together and avoid speech. We are all in this together. We are all in the same state of despair, but we sort of avoid talking to each other very much. The Tumid River, Tumid means swollen, suggestion of the river, the Acheron, which separates, in Dante, the world of the living and the world of the dead. We've gathered on the beach of the river. waiting to go over to the world of the dead. But we haven't done anything, either positive or negative. We can hardly even die. Excuse me. He says, we are sightless unless the eyes reappear. It's only through faith that salvation is possible. The emblem of the star, of course, is an emblem of Christ's nativity. The rose is also an emblem of Christ, and it's an emblem of the Virgin Mary. In Dante, in the Paradise, Dante uses the image of the rose, the petals being the souls of the blessed. And of course, faith, the possibility of faith, is only an empty hope of the hollow men. And the hollow men are empty because they cannot deny themselves to the extent required for faith. Part 5 starts out like a nursery rhyme. Here we go round the prickly pear, the prickly pear, the prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Notice the misuse or different use of images again. We know here we go round the mulberry bush, the mulberry bush. A mulberry bush is something that provides food. It's a pleasant kind of a bush. A prickly pear is a kind of cactus. It has fruit, but the fruit is prickly and almost inedible. And he sees that as the state of 20th century man going around a prickly pear instead of around a mulberry bush. Meaninglessness of life in a spiritually sterile world. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. For thine is, life is, for thine is the... This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. Between the idea and the reality, the shadow that falls between all of these things that might possibly lead to some kind of spiritual reality, the shadow is the negative character of the dry land that we live in. We are children of our time, and the shadow is always with us. We are not able to make the final and necessary surrender of self to find meaning with God. And this inability to achieve faith causes sterility in the hollow men. We are dry, unproductive. We are not able to do anything that is spiritually meaningful. And the last line of the poem, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. The bang of the gunpowder plot at least was positive, even if it was evil. And we hollow men find ourselves longing for some positiveness, even if it isn't good. But our world won't even end with a bang. All it can end with is a whimper. You notice also a comment, this is the way the world ends, and you think of the liturgical world without end, amen. The little prayers, for thine is the kingdom, life is very long, for thine is the kingdom. The hollow men try to pray, they need and desire faith, but are not able to achieve it. And the juxtaposition again of the nursery rhyme doggerel with the short chopped lines suggest the sense and despair and frustration of the hollow men. Should we just read through the whole thing again after the comment?
Sure.
That help? Okay. Mr. Kurtz, he did. A penny for the old guy. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men leaning together. headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams in death's dream kingdom, these do not appear. There the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There is a tree swinging, and voices are in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rat's coat, crow skin, crossed staves in a field, behaving as the wind behaves, no nearer. Not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here the stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in death's other kingdom, waking alone, at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness, lips that would kiss, form prayers to broken stone? The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdoms. In this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the Tumid River, sightless, unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of death's twilight kingdom, the hope only of empty men. Here we go round the prickly pear, prickly pear, prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. For thine is, life is. For thine is the, this is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Not optimistic. Ed mentioned at lunch yesterday that he doesn't like Gerontian, but I'm going to inflict it upon him anyway. This has some good images. The whole thing, again, is very pessimistic. He sees modern life as being dry and arid without spiritual reality. But, yeah, Jane?
Is that necessarily so pessimistic? I mean, it can lead you into...
No, go ahead.
Well, if it's true, it's not pessimistic. And it can lead to new hope.
Okay. I guess it's pessimistic only if it's not true. And Eliot thinks that it is true.
It means it's true for him, and that can lead to new hope and finding a new way to live outside it.
Okay.
Within it, but beyond it.
Okay.
So, I like Eliot a lot.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. No, I don't dislike Eliot at all.
No,
it's just that he's such a contrast from Hopkins. That, yeah.
With this poem, you were grounding it really solidly, like in 20th century mentality kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yet he draws in so many images from Dante, the 1500s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just interested in comment on that.
Okay. I think in the lost souls in Purgatory, he sees a parallel with our lostness. Have any of you read Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis? Okay. Do you remember at the very end, it's sort of an epilogue, Screwtape proposes a toast where there's a college of graduating devils and a college for young devils, and Screwtape is proposing the toast on the occasion of their graduation, and he warns them about what a hard time they are going to have. He sort of apologizes, too, for the tastelessness of the banquet, because the days of the really good sinners have passed. We no longer have tasty little morsels like the Borgias or the popes of the 15th, 16th centuries. We don't even have any really good heretics nowadays to provide flavor to the sauces that the cook has given us for our dinner. In that, too, he suggested that we are rather blah. Even our sins aren't grand and glorious sins. They tend to be little petty, piddling sins. And I think that's the idea that...
We can't even sin.
That Eliot goes... Yeah, we can't even sin like the medieval people could. We aren't as good as they were, but we aren't good sinners either. And I think a lot of Eliot's references to Dante go back to the idea somehow of positiveness. Maybe it was a sin, but it was still something positive. It was a force. It wasn't just sitting and being acted upon rather than acting.
So he can use that to show our impotence.
Mm-hmm. Our hollowness, where we are hollow people filled with straw. Let's look at Gerontian. And since we've already talked about a lot of the images of dryness, you know what they are. This was originally intended as a preface to The Wasteland, which has been regarded as the most influential poem of the 20th century. Excuse me. The title, Gerontian, means little old man, and it's representative of 20th century Western civilization as it has been secularized and despiritualized, living an empty life with only memories of a heroic past and one-time affirmations. The epilogue comes from Shakespeare, Measure for Measure, Act 3, Scene 1, where the Duke is remarking on the futility of life. Thou hast neither youth nor age, but as it were, an after-dinner sleep, dreaming of both. Measure for Measure, Act 3, Scene 1. Again, the image of being caught in a limbo, neither young nor old, but taking a nap, dreaming of both youth and age. Here I am, an old man in a dry month, being read to by a boy, waiting for rain. I was neither at the hot gates, nor fought in the warm rain, nor knee-deep in the salt marsh, heaving a cutlass, bitten by flies, fought. My house is a decayed house, and the Jew squats on the windowsill, the owner, spawned in some estaminet of Antwerp, blistered in Brussels, patched and peeled in London. The goat coughs at night in the field overhead. Rocks, moss, stone crop, iron, merds. The woman keeps the kitchen, makes tea, sneezes at evening, poking the peevish gutter. I, an old man, a dull head among windy spaces. The wind imagery recurs in this, the idea of dryness. It's not a moist, rain-bringing wind. It's a dry wind. A vacuum, yeah. A dull head among windy spaces. Emptiness. Waiting for rain, waiting for something that would give life. Blind, being read to by a boy, he can no longer even read for himself. But he remembers some of the glories of past human history. Hot Gates is Thermopylae, where in 480 BC, the Spartans died holding off the invading Persians. Fought in the warm rain, nor knee-deep in the salt marsh, heaving a cutlass. That has suggestions of the New World. The Spanish explorers came and plowed through the marshes, heaving cutlasses in the New World. My house is a decayed house. Both the old man's body and his civilization, as well as his dwelling, are decaying. The Jew squats on the windowsill, the owner, The Jew has, for centuries, been sort of an international symbol of a scapegoat. And we don't even need to think only in terms of our own century, but throughout history, the persecution that the Jews have gone through shows their view in that way. An estaminet is a dive, or a tavern, a low place. Antwerp, Brussels, London, these suggest that this dry, decaying situation is not limited to one geographical area. It's throughout Western civilization. The goat coughs at night in the field overhead. The fact that ground is overhead suggests a grave, and the goat coughing was believed to be a sign of the plague, just as sneezing was considered to be a sign of the plague. And of course, the plague means death. Again, images of dryness, rocks, moss. Stonecrop is a kind of plant that grows among rocks. Murds are feces. Civilization is dry, decaying, fetid. Signs are taken for wonders. We would see a sign. The word within a word, unable to speak a word, swaddled in darkness. In the juvescence of the year came Christ the tiger. In deprived May, dogwood and chestnut, flowering Judas, to be eaten, to be divided, to be drunk, among whispers. By Mr. Silvero with caressing hands at Limoges, who walked all night in the next room. By Hakagawa, bowing among the Titians. By Madame de Tornquist in the dark room, shifting the candles. Fräulein von Kulp, who turned in the hall, one hand on the door. Vacant shuttles weave the wind. I have no ghosts. An old man in a drafty house, under a winning, windy knob. We would see a sign, of course, is a quote from Matthew 12, 38-39, where people came to Christ asking for signs. The next lines refer to a nativity sermon preached in London by Lancelot Andrews, 1618. Word within a word, unable to speak a word, swaddled with darkness. We know that image also from the first chapter of the Gospel of John. Christ, the Word made flesh. As an infant, he could not speak a word, but came. Then the juvescence of the year is the youth of the year, a reference to Good Friday and Easter, when the trees were blossoming, flowering. Flowering Judas is a tree, but there's also, obviously, the reference to Judas Iscariot. Came Christ the tiger, to be eaten, to be divided, to be drunk. Reference to the Eucharist. But there's also a hint there of the primitive habit of eating a fierce animal in order to gain its attributes. If you were able to kill and then eat a part of the tiger, you would then take into yourself some of the tiger's courage and bravery and strength. Again, the names. Mr. Silvero, that's an Italian-sounding name. Hakagawa, Japanese. Madame de Tornquist, Fräulein von Kulp. All of these people have known about Christ the tiger waiting to be eaten and to be divided and to be drunk. But the Holy Communion has become debased and meaningless. Vacant shuttles weave the wind. Reference to Job chapter 7, verses 6 and 7. Our memories, our historical knowledge, doesn't really help us very much. It doesn't prevent us from being empty. Those of you who know anything about weaving, know what would happen if you had an empty shuttle trying to weave the wind. It would produce exactly nothing after an awful lot of effort. And that's what he's saying about our condition.
reference to Job?
Oh, Job 7, verses 6 and 7.
Where in here?
Vacant shuttles weave the wind. After Job has had all of his possessions taken away from him and he's sitting on the dung heap. There's a reference. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? Think now, history has many cunning passages, contrived corridors and issues, deceives with whispering ambitions, guides us by vanities. Think now, she gives when our attention is distracted, and what she gives, gives with such supple confusions that the giving famishes the craving. Gives too late what's not believed in, or if still believed, in memory only, reconsidered passion. Gives too soon into weak hands, what's thought can be dispensed with, till the refusal propagates a fear. Think, neither fear nor courage saves us. Unnatural vices are fathered by our heroism. Virtues are forced upon us by our impudent crimes. These tears are shaken from the wrath-bearing tree. The tiger springs in the new year, us he devours. Think at last, we have not reached a conclusion when I stiffen in a rented house. Think at last, I have not made this show purposelessly, and it is not by any concitation of the backward devils. I would meet you upon this honestly. I that was near your heart was removed therefrom, to lose beauty in terror, terror in inquisition. I have lost my passion. Why should I need to keep it, since what is kept must be adulterated? I have lost my sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch. How should I use it for your closer contact? After such knowledge, what forgiveness? Historical knowledge doesn't really tell us very much about salvation. We know about people in the past and how heroic they were, but if we think we can be as heroic as they were, we are deluded. It says, history has many cunning passages, guides us by vanities, things that are in vain. Think now, she gives when our attention is distracted. She is history. And the repetition of gives, 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 giving, gives, refers to the gifts that we are given by history. Our faith is dry and not very effectual, because what we believe in, if we believe in anything, is often a historical reconstruction. What she gives, gives with such supple confusions that the giving famishes the craving. Notice that contradiction. A craving usually needs to be satisfied, but he says that the gifts we get famish it even more. We are given things either too soon to make use of them or too late to make use of them. Unnatural vices are fathered by our heroism. Virtues are forced upon us by our impudent crimes. We do good things for the wrong reasons, or in attempting to do good for good reasons, we do terrible things. These tears are shaken from the wrath-bearing tree. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, about which we've heard this week. Also, the cross bore the wrath of God, the wrath of the world upon it. The tiger springs in the new year, Christ and his resurrection. Us he devours. Think at last, we have not reached conclusion when I stiffen in a rented house. The body is getting stiff. My body does not belong to me. I only rent it. It has another owner. I think he's told us that the Jew was the owner of the house, and I think there could be a connection there. Christianity stems from Judaism. We might like to think that we own our beliefs, but really they come from an earlier belief. Concitation is a stirring up or an arousing. The backward devils are false prophets, the soothsayers and the seers. And this again is a reference to Dante, where the false prophets had their heads on backwards. He says, "Think at last, I have not made this show purposelessly, and it is not by any consultation of the backward devils. I would meet you upon this honestly." He's not just being perverse. He wants to try to be honest about his spiritual condition. "I that was near your heart, near Christ's heart, was removed therefrom to lose beauty in terror, terror in questioning. I have lost my passion. Why should I need to keep it, since what is kept must be adulterated? I have lost my sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch." All of these are the effects of age. As we age, we lose the capabilities and the senses that we had in youth. "How should I use my body for your closer contact?" Even his old body is separating him from any contact that he may have once had with Christ. "These, with a thousand small deliberations, protract the profit of their chilled delirium, excite the membrane when the sense has cooled, with pungent sauces, multiply variety in a wilderness of mirrors. What will the spider do? Suspend its operations? Will the weevil delay? De Beilhach, Fresca, Mrs. Camel, world beyond the circuit of the shuddering bear in fractured atoms. Gull against the wind in the windy straits of Belle Isle, or running on the horn, white feathers in the snow, the gulf claims, and an old man driven by the trades to a sleepy corner. Tenants of the house, thoughts of a dry brain in a dry season." "A thousand small deliberations protract the profit of their chilled delirium, excite the membrane when the sense has cooled with pungent sauces." When we have been dulled, when our sensitivity has been dulled so that we can't even taste, we add pepper and curry to the sauce to try to get some sensation of flavor. "Multiply variety in a wilderness of mirrors." And this seems to be a reference to a story told by Seneca of the depraved Horatius Quadra, who accommodated his lust by surrounding himself with mirrors to multiply and group his scenes of vice. Just to commit an act of vice was not sufficient. He could only gain enjoyment and pleasure if he had himself surrounded by mirrors so he could see it multiplied. What does that say about the 20th century? Oh, yeah.
Bill and I have been doing it.
I have a builder acquaintance who built a house for a very wealthy person in Seattle, and the bedroom walls and ceiling were mirrors. Enough said. The spider, of course, is a symbol of the destructiveness of time. The spider builds its web in ruins. The spider builds its web where there's nothing much going on. We can't expect that the spider will suspend its operations or that the weevil will cease its depredations in the flower bin. Again, the random names suggesting the international character of this. World beyond the circuit of the shuddering bear in fractured atoms. The bear is the constellation Ursa Major, the Big Dipper. Gull against the wind in the windy straits of Belle Isle. Belle Isle is between Newfoundland and Canada, and gulls often fly with the wind to use it, but here the image is of the gull against the wind. Running on the horn, that's Cape Horn at the southern tip of South America. White feathers in the snow, the gulf claims, the wind strips the feathers from the gulls. We are helpless, driven before the wind of history. We don't have much to say about where we're going. An old man driven by the trades, the trade winds, that could also be the forces of modern commerce and commercialism, driven to a sleepy corner. And then he calls all of these thoughts that he has given expression to, tenants of the house, tenants of the body, thoughts of a dry brain in a dry season. A question is asked, and I think Ed brought this up yesterday too. Why did Eliot write with so many references that you have to have several sets of encyclopedias nearby when you're trying to read him? And I don't know that he set out to do that deliberately. I think his own education formed the way he wrote. He had studied Dante. He was not pressured to be educated towards a career the way most of us are now. We go to college to learn how to do something. He had a liberal arts education in a very broad sense. He was free just to study philosophy and to study Dante and to study poetry and art. He didn't have to worry about going into the family business. And the things that he studied and learned filled his brain, so when he was trying to express his inmost feelings, then it was natural for these images to come out. I have to do an awful lot of studying to make any sense out of Eliot, but these are just things that came out of him, just as I have a terrible time trying to understand what on earth a computer programmer is talking about when he's telling me what I have to do to get the computer to work. He knows, but I have to struggle to understand what he's trying to tell me. In the same way, Eliot has all of these immense images, these historical references in his mind, and they just come pouring out in his poetry.
When I need a response, I feel so overwhelmed. I would never want to try and write a poem after this. Because it's just so, like, every word of mine is so careful.
Every word is loaded. Let's look at the Journey of the Magi. The Journey of the Magi and A Song for Simeon are two of Eliot's post-conversion poems. And they have a more positive feeling, not joyous or not really tremendously optimistic and happy and, well, now everything's all taken care of. He still has a sense of bleakness, but he no longer is rebelling against the aridity and the bleakness as he has been in Durante and the Hollow Men. The Journey of the Magi, again, there are references to Lancelot Andrews's Nativity Sermon of 1618. The speaker of the poem is one of the three wise men. Well, one of the wise men. We don't know how many there were. Sometimes when I say that, people are shocked because we assume that there were three, but that's only a tradition. Nowhere in Scripture does it say how many wise men there were. There may have been two. There may have been a dozen. The only thing we know about them is that there were more than one. And Eliot tells the story of the journey. The critic Williamson says, this is not a piece of antiquarianism, but a recreation of the biblical story in Eliot's use of history as something that continues to happen. This journey of the Magi is not something that happened once and then was suddenly over. The effect of it continues. A cold coming we had of it, just at the worst time of year for a journey, and such a journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces and silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we have had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with voices singing in our ears, saying that all this was folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating in the darkness, and three trees on a low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door, dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued, and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. The first stanza just gives the practical details of the journey. You notice there's no mention of the star leading them, no mention of the dream, no mention of what they're hoping to find, but there's an expression of determination. They ignore the voices singing in our ears saying that this was all folly. They ignore that and keep on with the journey towards something they are driven to find. In the second stanza, there are images that suggest what is coming to the child they are seeking for. And even at the same excuse me, at the same time that there's precision and clarity of the external detail, we sense a sort of uncertainty as to what the ultimate significance of it all is. The running stream and the watermill beating in the darkness excuse me, suggest the vital forces, and the beating of the watermill suggests the throbbing of life. This is a fertile valley where the business of life is going on. It's not like the snow-covered hills that they have just come down from. The three trees on the low sky foreshadow Golgotha. The old white horse galloping away in the meadow is a reference to Revelation 6:2 or 19:11, reference to the last times. The vine leaves over the lintel of the tavern are a suggestion of fruitfulness, the joy of life. And of course, the six hands at the open door dicing for pieces of silver suggest the gambling at the foot of the cross, and also the silver that Judas got for his betrayal. So we continued and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. Understatement, exclamation mark. Satisfactory is a very understated way of expressing what they must have felt finding the one that they had been searching for so long. And yet there's something of a sense of anticlimax, as though they, when they saw the child and the parents, they didn't really know, was this really what we had come for? Isn't there more to it than this? And then the question, were we led all that way for birth or death? There was birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. Their faith remains, but still question about what the implications of this birth really are. The birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. The agony that they felt is beyond just the physical hardships of the journey. Perhaps the agony in knowing that if they really are to follow this child whom they found, they are going to have to die to themselves, die to the old way of living. He says, we return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation. Having seen the Christ, they cannot really go back to their old way of life with an alien people clutching the gods. The old way of life had a certain ease to it, but now having gone through the journey, they can't return to that old way of life any longer. They went to a birth, but the rebirth was a death to the old life, And there's a contrast between the matter-of-fact, almost dull tone of the poem, just a matter-of-fact account of the journey, and yet the extraordinary effect that it has had on the speaker when he realizes that he has in fact been called to his own death and his own rebirth.
Don't you see hope in that?
Oh yeah. This is a post-conversion poem. There is a something has been found. There is something worthwhile. The death required for rebirth is hard and bitter agony, but it is a positive thing. Any comments? You like that better than Girondian?
I like Girondian if I have someone explaining it all the way.
Oh, good. I'm not sure that it's Eliot's poems are the kind of thing that one enjoys reading. And I have the feeling that they are the things that I ought to, in quotation marks, read more often than I do. But there, he says such a lot. And this last line of The Journey of the Magi, I should be glad of another death. Wow. The only thing that could make us glad for death is if we die to ourselves in order to gain rebirth in Christ. That I think is probably the death that we can be glad of.
The top five lines are in quotation.
Apparently because that is a paraphrase of the lines of Lancelot Andrews' Nativity Sermon. Eliot starts out with those lines and then continues on. I have not been able to find Lancelot Andrews' Nativity Sermon of 1618 anywhere, but I have found critics who have quoted blocks of it. So.
What was the date?
1618. Let's look at a song for Simeon. Oh, okay. Yeah. And this, too, is a retelling, a restatement of a story we are all familiar with from Scripture. Oh, is it okay to go on for a few more minutes?
Uh-huh.
Or do you have to go? Okay. Simeon, you remember, was the old man in the temple who had been waiting for the Messiah to be born. The reference is Luke 2, 25 through 35. This poem has a different tone, a different voice than The Journey of the Magi, but it presents another viewpoint of the experience of rebirth, the experience of the discovery of a new focus for existence. Simeon, like Gerontion, is an old man suspended between dying and birth, birth and dying. Lord, the Roman hyacinths are blooming in bowls, and the winter sun creeps by the snow hills. The stubborn season has made stand. My life is light, waiting for the death wind like a feather on the back of my hand. Dust in sunlight and memory in corners wait for the wind that chills towards the dead land. Grant us thy peace. I have walked many years in this city, kept faith and fast, provided for the poor, have given and taken honor and ease. There went never any rejected from my door. Who shall remember my house? Where shall live my children's children when the time of sorrow is come? They will take to the goat's path and the fox's home, fleeing from the foreign faces and the foreign swords. Before the time of cords and scourges and lamentation, grant us thy peace. Before the stations of the mountain of desolation, before the certain hour of maternal sorrow, now at this birth season of decease, let the infant, the still unspeaking and unspoken word, grant Israel's consolation to one who has 80 years and no tomorrow. According to thy word, they shall praise thee and suffer in every generation with glory and derision, light upon light, mounting the saint's stair. Not for me the martyrdom, the ecstasy of thought and prayer, not for me the ultimate vision, grant me thy peace. And a sword shall pierce thy heart, thine also. I am tired with my own life and the lives of those after me. I am dying in my own death and the deaths of those after me. Let thy servant depart, having seen thy salvation. The Roman hyacinths suggest foreign domination, and of course we know that Simeon at this time in Jerusalem was under Roman rule. I'm sorry, I think my cough is affecting my powers of speech. No, it's okay, thank you. The winter, the season of decease, the season of death, when nothing is growing. How about this image? My life is light, waiting for the death wind like a feather on the back of my hand. He is so frail, his grip on life is so tenuous that just a breath can blow his life away in the same way that we can hardly breathe and blow a feather off our hand. He's waiting for death to come. In the second stanza, we learn that Simeon has been a good and a faithful servant. He has kept faith and fast. He's provided for the poor. But he realizes that these will not mean much towards his salvation. They will not mean much when the time of destruction comes. He says, "Who shall remember my house? Where shall live my children's children when the time of sorrow is come?" A reference to Luke 23, verses 29 through 31, where Christ, on his way to Golgotha, speaks to the women and foretells the destruction of Jerusalem, the dispersion of the people after Rome has destroyed Jerusalem. They will take to the goat's path and the fox's home. And of course, the fox's home is a hole in the side of the hill, fleeing from the Roman sword. Before the time of cords and scourges and lamentation, grant us thy peace. A reference there to the crucifixion, but also to the slavery and the driving out of the Jews from Jerusalem. The stations of the cross, and also the desolation of the Jews after their dispersion. The certain hour of maternal sorrow refers, of course, to the sorrow of Mary at the cross, but also the sorrow of mothers. Jesus in Luke 23 tells the women of Jerusalem to weep for their children who will be dispersed. Let the infant, the still unspeaking and unspoken word, grant Israel's consolation to one who has 80 years and no tomorrow. Again, Christ is spoken of as the unspoken word. The tiny infant, unable to speak yet, is the incarnation of the Word of God, but has not yet spoken that word. They shall praise thee and suffer in every generation, light upon light, mounting the saints' stair. There's potential for new intensity and new joy and new greatness in living in the post-Messiah era. But he says, not for me, that ultimate vision. Grant me thy peace. He is an old man, his life is about to end, and he feels that he will not be able to do anything in the glory of the new era that he sees being brought in by this tiny infant. The words to Mary, foretelling Christ's death, a sword shall pierce thy heart, thine also. I am tired with my own life and the lives of those after me. Simeon is an old man. He's tired. He doesn't particularly want to go through the rigors of mounting the saint's stair. He is perfectly willing, having seen the potential for salvation, to die quietly and accept what the birth of the new word will mean. The birth of the new word destroys the pattern of the old dispensation, as it did in the journey of the Magi. Simeon has been waiting for the consolation of Israel. but he also foresees that the consequences of this infant's coming will not be easy ones. To embrace the new life offered by the Christ will also be to embrace suffering and death. Let thy servant depart, having seen thy salvation. In the group that I handed out to you stapled, I have also put Ash Wednesday, which was Eliot's long poem. And I know we certainly don't have time for it. I don't know if any of you would like to spend some time going through it. We can. I've been living with Ash Wednesday since last September, and I have to say that it is very difficult and very abstruse, and I have not been able to feel that it is a coherent whole the way I can about the others that we've looked at today. It's very long, and there is some optimism. There is a sense of the possibility of spiritual reality, which there is not in Gerontion or the Hollow Man. But it's...
When was this one written?
Part one was written in 1928, part two in 1927, part three in 1929, and then the whole was put together and published in April of 1930. So it was written over a span of several years.
So,
I offer, yes, the words and the images are beautiful, and I think you could probably read it and gain something without understanding what the images all mean.
Yeah.
And
because I just read it this week, and I thought, I loved it, there was parts of this thing I don't get. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The part about the bones, of course, that's a reference to Ezekiel. The Valley of the Dry Bones. The life. Libran? Oh, the bones. Uh-huh. Yeah. Whiteness has the image of light and goodness. They're opposites, the garden and the desert, the world and God. The lady that he refers to seems to serve several functions. The idea of love, also the Virgin Mary, also holy people who spend time praying. A reference, I think, to nuns and those in religious seclusion who pray. There's just so much. Again, the rose image recurs, the rose for Christ and the beauty of salvation. Again, many references to Dante and the paradise and purgatory. Phrases from the liturgy, pray for us sinners now in the hour, at the hour of our death, is from the Ave Maria. Let's see. Lord, I am not worthy, I am not worthy. A reference to Matthew 8, when the Roman comes to Christ begging for healing for his servant, saying, I am not worthy that you should enter my house, but speak the word only, and he will be healed. Color. Eliot does a lot with color in Ash Wednesday. The white of the dry bones, the blue of the lady's garment, the blue of the stones in the garden, the green of the life in the garden.
I don't get that part four.
Part four? I'm not sure I do either. Let's see. Each section has sort of a little catchphrase or a catchword indicating the theme of it. And the one for part four is resurgent faith. I don't know if that helps at all. There are paradoxes, as in all of Eliot. Let's see. In ignorance and in knowledge of eternal dollar. Dollar is sorrow. There's a paradox. We're partially aware of the divine, but also ignorant of what the divine truly is.
Where are you reading that?
Oh, about the sixth line down. In ignorance and in knowledge of the eternal dollar. Again, the image, one who moves in time between sleep and waking, that recalls the image in the earlier poems, the time between birth and death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That the time between living and dying.
So,
sort of a suspension.
Mm-hmm.
Unicorns. In medieval symbolism, Christ is shown as a unicorn drawing the Ark of the Covenant. He refers to jeweled unicorns draw by the gilded hearse. Of course, a hearse, the supreme token of love, Christ's sacrifice. And unicorns are also associated with the Virgin. In medieval understanding, the only way to catch a unicorn was to take a virgin out into the forest and leave her alone, and the unicorn would come to her. So the link between the Virgin Mary and the unicorn. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.